massive wildfire is still blazing on the Greek island of Rhodes as dozens more erupt across the country.
It was impossible to get onto coaches because people just ran. It was literally like the end of the world. And the flames were now far more visible. Suddenly they were leaping flames into the sky.
Plus, why hundreds of thousands of Israelis are taking to the streets in the largest and longest sustained protests in the country's history.
It's a moment unlike any other that Israel has really ever seen. And they've arrived in Jerusalem, they're camping out, and it's this spectacular show of force by a civilian population that's just saying absolutely not in this legislation.
And superheroes and villains gathered in San Diego over the weekend for the 2023 Comic-Con comic book convention. Today is Monday, July 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Firefighters struggled through the night to contain 82 wildfires across Greece, 64 of which started Sunday, the hottest day of summer so far. The most serious fire is on the island of Rhodes. Some 19,000 people have been evacuated from several locations on Rhodes as wildfires burned for a sixth day, and authorities warn more fires could follow as temperatures climb. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has this report.
A wildfire roars in the Greek island of Rhodes, marking 6 days since the blaze began. A multinational effort is underway to help contain the disaster that sent more than 19,000 people scrambling for safety. Adding to the danger in Greece are temperatures climbing north of 45 degrees Celsius, paired with dry conditions and island winds known to change speed and direction. Dozens of private boats teamed up with the Coast Guard to ferry away the thousands who made their way to the Greek shoreline in what authorities there described as one of the biggest evacuation efforts in the country's history. One government official said maritime rescue carried 3,000 people to safety, while others gathered outside of schools and gymnasiums for a chance at securing a mattress on a basketball court and staying out of harm's way. Rhodes is a tourist destination known for its long beaches. It is also home to more than 100,000 people who've been living in the cloud of this wildfire for nearly a week. But they are not alone. Firefighters elsewhere in Greece recently battled blazes to the north and west of the capital, Athens. Unrelenting heat waves have contributed to that fire, and experts warn this could be the new normal.
These events will continue to grow in intensity, and the world needs to prepare for more intense heat waves. The recently declared El Niño is only expected to amplify the occurrence and intensity of extreme heat events. So we're in for a bit of a ride, I'm afraid. And they will have quite serious impacts on human health and livelihoods.
El Niño is a climate pattern which describes warming waters that can result in significant shifts of ground conditions and temperature, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. The fires near Athens and on the island of Rhodes are among dozens Greek authorities have struggled to contain and keep from spreading to nearby forests. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Record-breaking high temperatures are expected to continue this week in several parts of the world as scientists link the extreme weather to climate change. Pope Francis urged world leaders to fight it. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
From Spain to Lebanon, to the United States. The heat keeps breaking records this summer. The World Meteorological Organization attributes it to global warming.
Buongiorno.
On Sunday, Pope Francis shed light to the suffering climate change causes to many living beings around the planet and the urgency to fight it.
I renew my appeal to the leaders of the nations to do something more concrete to limit polluting emissions. It's an urgent challenge and cannot be put off. It concerns everyone. Let us protect our common home.
Unhoused populations and anyone who isn't used to long periods of scorching temperatures could be at risk. warned Palm Springs, California Mayor Grace Lena Garner, who was interviewed by ABC News.
When your body isn't used to these high temperatures, it can go into a shock. So if we don't act now, if we don't make sure that we're putting in the actions that we need to reduce the impacts of climate change, we are just going to see this get worse and worse.
Asked on ABC's This Week's show whether climate change is a national security threat, Republican Representative Michael McCaul replied.
The climate is changing. And when you have arid, you know, Africa, for instance, is becoming more and more arid, which, you know, famine, you know, breaks out of that. Terrorism breaks out of that. Those conditions.
Last week, China and the United States, the two largest emitters of greenhouse gases, resumed talks on how to tackle the problem. But there were no breakthroughs. It will take a concerted effort to make a difference, said Washington State Governor Jay Inslee on ABC's This Week.
This is a solvable problem, but we need to stop using fossil fuels. That is the only solution to this massive assault on humanity.
Forecasters expect the heat waves to continue for several more days, if not weeks, in various parts of the world. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was recovering in a hospital on Sunday after an emergency heart procedure as massive weekend protests continued over his government's judicial overhaul plan and an expected vote in parliament on Monday. For seven straight months, tens of thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets over the plan that could potentially shape Israel's future. I spoke with Elisheva Goldberg, Senior Director of Media and Policy with the New Israel Fund, for analysis on what this plan is and what prompted these unprecedented protests.
The thing that prompted this was a package of legislation that, as soon as the Netanyahu government got into power, the justice minister proposed. It was a package of legislation that would basically reduce the power of the judiciary to almost nothing. And in Israel, the judiciary is the only real check on the power of the government. And so it would give the government a kind of majoritarian autocracy. It would be able to do whatever it wanted. The legislature could just pass anything and no one would stand in its way. And that package of legislation was what prompted these protests that have gone on, as you say, for 7 months. I mean, it's crazy. This is the 29th week of protests. The thing is, there was a pause and there was those protests result. They said stop and the government kind of had to stop. The labor union said, everyone went on strike. And so Netanyahu was like, whoa, let's press pause. And they pressed pause. And then they had these compromise talks and now they're back. And the legislation that they put on the table is not this package of legislation that would allow like the complete demise of the judiciary, but it's one piece of that package. And the piece is about this thing called the reasonableness clause, which allows the Supreme Court in Israel to annul a decision made by ministers and the government that is usually an administrative decision, something that has to do with appointments or firings. And the reason that this has everyone up in arms is both because it would take away a significant power from the judiciary. Like it would matter. For example, when Netanyahu tried to appoint one of his ministers, a man named Aryeh Deri from Shas, who the court said no. And the reason the court said no was that Aryeh Deri has been convicted of tax fraud three times. And the court thought it was unreasonable for Netanyahu to be able to appoint somebody like that to his cabinet. And they used the reasonableness clause. They said that's not reasonable. And the only thing standing between, you know, that kind of appointment and Aryeh Deri as a minister in the cabinet is the reasonableness clause. Now, there's one other reason that's really significant, and that is that Netanyahu is still on trial. And so this is also what prompted this whole thing. Netanyahu used to be somebody who said, I will protect the court. I will make sure that the court is strong. And now you're seeing him trying to weaken the court. And the real reason there is because he's on trial for breach of trust, corruption, and fraud himself. And he really wants to fire the attorney general. His communications minister actually said a while back that the only thing standing between Netanyahu firing the attorney general is the reasonableness clause, that this precise thing is the thing standing between Israel and removing one of the most important gatekeepers of the law in Israel.
You've got the country's main labor union actually considering a strike. Thousands of military reservists, or at least a group representing them and reservists themselves, saying they'll resign from military duty if this goes into effect. And of course, that has the country's defense minister concerned about the growing refusal to serve in the military and what that could mean for Israel's safety.
Yeah, I think people really feel like they have no choice. I think that a lot of people, especially these reservists you're talking about, I mean, there's a letter, the big letter, like the declaration of 1,000, you know, reserve pilots and navigators was a big moment for the protest movement. There have been countless reservists who have said this, that they will not serve under what they are calling a dictatorship, because without the judiciary, as I said, Israel is not a functional democracy. There is only one branch of government. And people feel like this is their home. This is the only place that they can live. And they can't live in that place if this happens. And so the stakes are really, really high. And you've seen these, the march that just happened, in addition to all of these things you're talking about, the labor unions and the reservists, there was a march the last 4 days from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And that march, the planners I know started thinking like, oh, we're going to get a couple hundred people, like, you know, maybe 1,000 people. There have been between 70 and 80,000 people marching. These are not people who are organized in any particular way necessarily, but we've seen different blocks and different groups like join this movement. And it's pretty spontaneous and it's very, very impressive. It's a moment unlike any other that Israel has really ever seen. And they've arrived in Jerusalem, they're camping out, and it's this spectacular show of force by a civilian population that's just saying absolutely not to this legislation. The incredible show of force that 70 to 80,000 people have shown up in Jerusalem. Pictures are astonishing. If you look at the Knesset, you look at this sea of people just spreading around the entire compound. I mean, it's all of Jerusalem is right now completely covered in protesters. It's quite amazing. And it really is about a vision of the country, right? Like ultimately, the big picture here is that you have these people who are saying, we want a democracy. We want a place where we can have differences of opinion, where we can have our rights protected by this court that stands for, in the minds of Israelis, liberalism, checks and balances. And on the other side, you actually have the theological and settler right. The thing that was astonishing to me to see was that there was a map of where the counter protesters are coming from, the people who are pro this legislation. The people who are coming to protest in favor of the legislation are almost all coming from the settlements. They're coming from illegal outposts. They're coming from deep in the West Bank, where democracy doesn't exist, where there actually is a separate system for Israelis with citizenship and for Palestinians who don't have citizenship. And so these are people who are not actually that interested in what we would call democracy. And so that's a really incredible contrast here. I mean, we're sort of seeing the results of having this 56-year-long occupation in the people who are actually showing up for the protests. And I think that's very telling and very important for this moment.
Elisheva Goldberg, Senior Director of Media and Policy with the New Israel Fund. Ukrainian officials say Russia again struck the Ukrainian Black Sea city of Odessa, keeping up a barrage that has damaged critical port infrastructure in southern Ukraine. At least one person was killed and 22 others wounded in the attack in the early hours of Sunday. The blasts also severely damaged the historic Transfiguration Cathedral, an Orthodox landmark in the city. Associated Press correspondent Mimi Montgomery has the story.
Ukraine's forces says a Russian attack on the Black Sea city of Odessa leaves one person killed and more than 20 wounded, including children. There are also reports of serious damage to Odessa's Transfiguration Cathedral, a significant Orthodox building. The latest strike is one of many recent Russian attacks damaging critical port infrastructure in Ukraine's south. Odessa is an important hub for exporting grain, and the attack comes days after Russia pulls out of a grain deal aimed at enabling exports to reach countries facing hunger. I'm Mimi Montgomery.
And we're following these other stories from around the world. Rescuers have ended a 4-day search for scores of people missing after heavy monsoon rains triggered a massive landslide in a village in western India. The mayor of the Ecuadorian Pacific port city of Manta was assassinated on Sunday in what authorities describe as a brazen attack that stunned the political establishment. And Spain's conservative Popular Party was set to narrowly win the country's national election Sunday, but without the majority needed to topple the coalition government of socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. Last September, NASA's Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART spacecraft, successfully carried out the first test of planetary defense when it intentionally crashed into an asteroid named Dimorphos at a speed of about 22.5 thousand kilometers per hour. While the impact slightly changed the asteroid's trajectory, it also made a 10,000 kilometer long trail of debris, according to images gathered by NOAA Labs' SOAR telescope. Using the Hubble Space Telescope, a team of scientists found a pack of 37 boulders measuring between 1 to 6.7 meters in diameter floating away from the asteroid at a speed of about 1 kilometer per hour. The European Space Agency plans to send its Hera spacecraft to conduct a follow-up survey of the binary asteroid system affected by DART in 2024. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. The U.S. Secretary of State is heading to Tonga, New Zealand, and Australia this week. He'll visit Tonga's capital to dedicate the new U.S. embassy there, part of an effort to ramp up America's diplomatic presence in the region to counter China's influence and pressure on Pacific Island nations. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken appears to be making good on the long-held U.S. foreign policy goal of a pivot to Asia. Having just returned from an ASEAN meeting in Jakarta, Indonesia last week, he is heading Monday to Tonga and then later to Australia and New Zealand. Blinken is the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit Tonga and will dedicate the brand new U.S. embassy in the capital, Nuku'alofa. When asked if the visit is to counter China's presence in the Pacific, Blinken had this to say Friday at the Aspen Security Forum in Colorado.
Well, it also has a lot to do with the relationships we're trying to build with these countries that have in the past been a little bit neglected.
China has a large embassy in Tonga and has been pouring money into infrastructure there and on other Pacific islands. Shihoko Goto, acting director for the Asia program and also the director of geoeconomics at the Wilson Center, tells VOA.
The United States is actually coming a little bit late into that game. Countries like Japan have been much more proactive in understanding the importance of these countries. The United States, by going there, engaging, is trying to compete toe-to-toe with China to win over the hearts and minds of the Pacific Islands.
The United States and its regional allies, Australia and New Zealand, have also been concerned that China has ambitions to build a naval base in the region since the Solomon Islands made a security pact with China last year. China's top concern is Taiwan, as some Pacific Island nations still recognize Taipei and do not have Chinese embassies on their soil, says Brian Harding, senior expert for Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands at the United States Institute of Peace.
Until recently, six Pacific Island countries still recognize Taipei. China has been very successful in the last few years, pulling away Solomon Islands and Kiribati. Now it's looking to do the same with some others.
Secretary Blinken will travel from Tonga to New Zealand, where he will cheer on the U.S. women's soccer team in the World Cup when they play against the Netherlands. His final stop on the tour is Australia. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Comic-Con 2023 happened over the weekend in San Diego. Without large movie studios and high-profile stars, some participants say the Hollywood actors and writer strikes are taking the event back to its comic book roots. For VOA, Jania Delow has the story.
San Diego is hosting the 54th annual Comic-Con, one of the world's largest pop culture conventions connecting writers and artists with fans of their comics and their screen adaptations. Superhero movie stars and major U.S. movie studios pulled out of this year's event because of the Hollywood actors and writers' strikes. But that has not diminished the enthusiasm of cosplayers, people who dress up as their favorite comic book, movie, or video game characters. Cosplay comes from two words, costume and play, playing with a costume to represent a character. This year, in order to fit into the vibrant Comic-Con scene, I decided to dress up as a Wonder Woman. Patricia Burns retired from the Navy. Today, she's the Marvel Comics superhero, Black Widow.
I'm 62 years old. That's why I say at any age, it's never too late. We all want to enjoy life, and what better way to do it is to reinvent ourselves. What are the limits? We put limits on ourselves. So I would say to anyone, no matter what race you are, what size you are, find you.
Ashley Lawrence and Keith Foster, or Barbie and Ken, are wearing space costumes to celebrate the Barbie movie premiere on Friday.
I looked through the catalog of Barbie, and this is actually from Barbie 1985 as Astronaut Barbie. She did exist, and so that's why I picked her.
Unfortunately, there was not an 85 Astronaut Ken, so I had to take some creative liberties.
IT engineer and Superman cosplayer Chris Perry says the absence of Hollywood superhero blockbusters at this year's show allows more room for the comic books at the core of the convention.
It definitely took the wind out of the sails a little bit, but one of the cool things that's coming from that is we're getting back to our roots. You know, it's all about the comic books. The pop culture, the TV, the movies, yeah, that's a lot of fun, but Comic-Con, when it first came out and originated, it was all about the comic books.
And attendees can find many comic books among the more than 500 exhibitors at this year's Comic-Con, along with pop culture merchandise, video games, and opportunities to discuss topics like promoting diversity in comics and graphic novels. Jenya Dulo for VOA News, San Diego.
And in the U.S. box office race between the movies Barbie and Oppenheimer, there was one clear winner over the weekend. Associated Press correspondent Margie Zarletta reports.
It is the best day ever. So is yesterday, and so is tomorrow, and every day from now until forever.
Pink and Plastic beat the A-bomb. Greta Gerwig's Barbie takes the top spot at the box office, ranking in $155 million in domestic ticket sales, according to industry figure. $0.5 million, putting it in second. Sound of Freedom is number three. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 is in fourth place. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny is number five. I'm Margie Zarletta.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During the Bosnian War, which lasted from 1992 to 1995, Bosnian Serbs, one of the large ethnic groups that made up the former country of Yugoslavia, was on a quest to establish an ethnically homogeneous homeland, the Republika Srpska. Standing in the center of their chosen territory was Srebrenica, historically the home to a majority Bosnian Muslim population. For 3 years, Bosnian Serb nationalists hounded and terrorized Srebrenica's Muslim Bosniak population. Finally, toward the end of the war, units of the Bosnian Serb Army of Republika Srpska, under the command of General Ratko Mladic, forced their way into the besieged enclave of Srebrenica, a safe area under United Nations protection. The Serbian troops rounded up the population, including hundreds of refugees from surrounding villages. They separated the women and youngest children, and then systematically murdered all males over the age of 15. Between July 11th and 31st, 1995, they massacred 7,000 to 8,000 unarmed men and boys. The 1948 United Nations Genocide Convention defines genocide as acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. And that is what happened in Srebrenica, according to a report issued in 2004 by the Commission for Investigation of the Events in and around Srebrenica. Back then, the government of Republika Srpska, now an autonomous region within Bosnia and Herzegovina, issued an official apology. But 14 years later, the National Assembly of Republika Srpska rejected the report, claiming that many of the victims are still alive. To this day, denial of the Srebrenica genocide and glorification of those who committed these acts are common within the region. Speaking at the 28th observance of the Srebrenica massacre, U.S. Ambassador to Bosnia and Herzegovina, Michael Murphy, said the American people stand in solidarity with the victims, the survivors, and families who grieve for their loved ones. The facts about the genocide in Srebrenica have been established beyond the shadow of a doubt, said Ambassador Murphy. The United States calls on the political leaders in Bosnia and Herzegovina to demonstrate respect for the truth, for the memory of the victims of the genocide in Srebrenica, and for the future of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which depends on their ability to acknowledge that genocide occurred in Srebrenica and take the necessary steps to right this and many other wrongs of the 1992 to 1995 war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.